Good evening. I'd like to welcome all of you to the New York Society Library, the oldest library in the city and the first library of Congress. George Washington took books out from this library, and I hope you will generously support the library and help us have wonderful programs like this. It's a great pleasure to welcome Kevin Kwan to the New York Society Library. I met Kevin several years ago when he was working with Michael Korda on a book presentation. Kevin provided backup photos, music, and information for Michael Korda's lecture on Lawrence of Arabia. He found amazing footage Lowell Thomas had taken of Lawrence blowing up railway lines, in addition to other information. In getting to know him, I'm astonished by all he does. Kevin Kwan was born and raised in Singapore, and graduated from Parsons School of Design and the University of Houston. He spent much of the 1990s working for Martha Stewart Living, Interview Magazine, and others. He developed commercial and cultural projects for such clients as the Museum of Modern Art and the New York Times. Over the past decade and a half, Kevin Kwan has managed to balance three diverse lives. As a writer, a fine arts photographer, and a creative consultant. His evocative nighttime photos have been exhibited internationally and acquired in public and private collections. In 2000, he established Kevin Kwan Projects to pursue a diverse array of publishing, commercial, and cultural ventures. Kevin has produced acclaimed visual books for Oprah, Gore Vidal, Larry McMurtry, and Elizabeth Taylor, to name but a few. He is the author of I Was Cuba and the co-author of Luck, The Essential Guide, which has been translated into 9 languages. Kevin also shares my devotion to chocolate and is an expert in the best chocolate shops in the city. Like his characters, he is a great appreciator of fine foods and has introduced me to a number of great Asian restaurants. Most recently, Dim Sum at Red Egg. Kevin's first novel, Crazy Rich Asian, has had phenomenal success. When I read it in galley form, I knew that it was destined for bestsellerdom. If I still had had books in company, I would have ordered hundreds of copies. When the book first came out, it seemed every time I picked up a paper or a magazine, there was a review or interview with Kevin. So far, the book will be published in France, Italy, Romania, United Kingdom, and Australia, and a film deal has been made. And now let us welcome Kevin, who will read briefly from his book, and then we'll have a discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeanette, for that lovely introduction, and thank you all for being here tonight on this night of strange weather. I'm going to read a short excerpt from my book, and just one quick footnote. There are footnotes throughout the entire book, but this one pertains to the word dato. A dato is a Malaysian honorific given by the Malay royal family, and it's basically the same as a knighthood. The wife of a dato is called a datin. So here we go. Chapter 2, Eleanor Young, Singapore. Everyone knew that Dato Tai To Lui made his first fortune the dirty way by bringing down Lung Ha Bank in the early 80s. But in the 2 decades since, the efforts of his wife, Datin Carol Tai, on behalf of the right charities, had burnished the Tai name into one of respectability. Every Thursday, for instance, the Datin held a Bible study luncheon for her closest friends in her bedroom, and Eleanor Young was sure to attend. Carol's palatial bedroom was not actually in the sprawling glass and steel structure everyone living on Kim Hock Road nicknamed the Star Trek House. Instead, on the advice of her husband's security team, the bedroom was hidden away in the pool pavilion, a white travertine fortress that spanned the swimming pool like a postmodern Taj Mahal. To get there, you either had to follow the footpath that wound along the coral rock gardens or take the shortcut through the service wing. Eleanor always preferred the quicker route, since she assiduously avoided the sun to maintain her porcelain-white complexion, and also, as Carol's oldest friend, she considered herself exempt from the formalities of waiting at the front door, being announced by the butler, and all that nonsense. Besides, Eleanor enjoyed passing through the kitchens. The old ama squatting over enamel double boilers would always open the lids for Eleanor to sniff the smoky medicinal herbs being brewed for Carol's husband. Natural Viagra, as he called it. And the kitchen maids gutting fish in the courtyard would fawn over how youthful Mrs. Young looked. For 60, what with her fashionably shagged chin-length hair and her unwrinkled face. Before furiously debating, the moment she was out of earshot, what expensive new cosmetics procedure Mrs. Young must have endured. By the time Eleanor arrived at Carol's bedroom, the Bible study regulars, Daisy Fu, Lorena Lim, and Nadine Shaw, would be assembled and waiting. Here, sheltered from the harsh equatorial's heat, these longtime friends would sprawl languorously about the room, analyzing Bible verses assigned in their study guides. The place of honor on Carol's Qing Dynasty bed was always reserved for Eleanor, for even though this was Carol's house and she was the one married to the billionaire financier, Carol still deferred to Eleanor. This was the way things had always been since their childhood as neighbors growing up on Serangoon Road, mainly because, coming from a Chinese-speaking family, Carol had always felt inferior to Eleanor, who was brought up speaking English first. The others also kowtowed to her because even among these exceedingly well-married ladies, Eleanor had trumped them all by becoming Mrs. Philip Young. Today's lunch started off with braised quail and abalone over hand-pulled noodles, and Daisy, married to the rubber tycoon QT Fu, but born a Wong of the Ipoh Wongs, fought to separate the starchy noodles while trying to find 1 Timothy in her King James Bible. At 64, she was the oldest of the ladies, and even though everyone insisted on reading the New American Standard, Daisy read from her version, saying, "I went to convent school and was taught by nuns, you know, so it will always be King James for me." Tiny droplets of garlicky broth splattered onto the tissue-like page, but she managed to keep the good book open with one hand while deftly maneuvering her ivory chopsticks with the other. Nadine, meanwhile, was busy flipping through her Bible, the latest issue of Singapore Tattle. Every month, she couldn't wait to see how many pictures of her daughter Francesca, the celebrated Shaw Foods heiress, were featured in the soiree section of the magazine. Nadine herself was a fixture in the society pages, what with her kabuki-esque makeup, tropical fruit-sized jewels, and over-teased hair. "Aya, Carol, Tattle devoted 2 full pages to your Christian Helper's fashion gala," Nadine exclaimed. "Already? I didn't realize it would come out so quickly," Carol remarked. Unlike Nadine, she was always a bit embarrassed to find herself in magazines. She simply felt obligated to attend a few charity galas every week, as any good born-again Christian should, and because her husband kept reminding her that being Mother Teresa was good for business. Eleanor eyed the pretty new mainland Chinese maid entering the room. "What do we have today?" she asked Carol as the maid placed a familiar, bulky mother-of-pearl chest beside the bed. "Oh, I wanted to show you what I bought on my Burma trip." Eleanor flipped the lid of the chest eagerly and began methodically taking out the stacked black velvet trays. One of her favorite parts of Thursday Bible study was looking at Carol's latest acquisitions. Soon the bed was lined with trays containing a blinding array of jewels. "What intricate crosses. I didn't realize they did such good setting work in Burma." "No, no, those crosses are Harry Winston," Carol corrected. "The rubies are from Burma." Lorena got up from her lunch and headed straight for the bed, holding up one of the lychee-sized rubies to the light. "Aya, you have to be so careful in Burma, because so many of these rubies are synthetically treated to boost the redness." Being the wife of Lawrence Lim, of the Lorient Jewelry Limbs, Lorena could speak on this topic with authority. "I thought the rubies from Burma were supposed to be the best," Eleanor remarked. "Ladies, you need to stop calling it Burma. It's been called Myanmar for many years now," Daisy corrected. "Alamak, you sound just like Nikki, always correcting me," Eleanor said. "Hey, speaking of Nick, when does he arrive from New York? Isn't he the best man at Colin Koo's wedding?" Daisy asked. "Yes, yes, but you know my son. I'm always the last to know anything," Eleanor complained. "Isn't he staying with you?" "Of course, he always stays with us first before heading to the old ladies," Eleanor said, using her nickname for her mother-in-law. "Well," Daisy continued, lowering her voice a bit, "what do you think old lady will do about his guest?"
"What do you mean?
What guest?" Eleanor asked.
"The one he's bringing to the wedding,"
Daisy replied slowly, her eyes darting around at the other ladies mischievously, knowing they all knew to whom she was referring.
What are you talking about? Who is he bringing? Eleanor said, a little confused. His latest girlfriend, Lorena revealed. No such thing. No way Nikki has a girlfriend, Eleanor insisted. Why is it so hard for you to believe that your son has a girlfriend? Lorena asked. She had always found Nick to be the most dashing young man of his generation, and with all that young money, it was such a pity her good-for-nothing daughter, Tiffany, never managed to attract him. But surely you've heard about this girl, the one from New York? Daisy said in a whisper, relishing that she was the one breaking the news to Eleanor. An American girl? Nikki wouldn't dare do such a thing. Daisy, your information is never reliable. It's always tapake. What do you mean? My news is not tapake. It comes from the most reliable source. Anyway, I hear she's Chinese, Daisy offered. Really? What's her name, and where is she from? Daisy, if you tell me she's from mainland China, I think I'll have a stroke, Eleanor warned. I hear she's from Taiwan, Daisy said carefully. Oh my goodness, I hope she's not one of those Taiwanese tornadoes, Nadine cackled. What do you mean by that? Eleanor asked. You know how notorious those Taiwanese girls can be. They swoop in unexpectedly, the men fall head over heels, and before you know it, they are gone. But not before sucking up every last dollar, just like a tornado, Nadine explained. At this moment, Carol's husband entered the room. Hello, hello, ladies. How is Jesus time today? He said, puffing away on his cigar and swirling his goblet of Hennessy, looking every portly inch the caricature of an Asian tycoon. Hello, Dato, the ladies said in unison, hardly shifting themselves into more decorous positions. Dato, Daisy here is trying to give me a stroke. She's telling everyone that Nikki has a new Taiwanese girlfriend, Eleanor cried. Relax, Eleanor. Taiwanese girls are lovely. They really know how to take care of a man. And maybe she'll be prettier than all those spoiled inbred girls you try to matchmake him to. The Dato grinned. Anyway, he continued, suddenly lowering his voice. If I were you, I'd be less worried about young Nicholas and more worried about Sina Land right now. Why? What's happening to Sina Land? Eleanor asked. Sina Land don't do. It's going to collapse, the Dato declared with a satisfied grin. But Sina Land is a blue chip. How can that be? My brother even told me they have all these new projects in Western China, Lorena argued. The Chinese government, my sources assure me, has pulled out of that huge new development in Xinjiang. I just unloaded my shares, and I'm shorting 100,000 shares every hour until market closes. With that, the Dato expelled a big puff of smoke from his cohiba and pressed a button next to the bed. The vast wall of glass facing the sparkling swimming pool began to tilt 45 degrees, like an enormous cantilevered door. The Dato lumbered out into the garden towards the main house. For a few seconds, the room went absolutely still. You could almost hear the wheels in each of these women's heads whirling into overdrive. Daisy suddenly jumped up from her chair, spilling the tray of noodles onto the floor. Quick, quick, where's my handbag? I need to call my broker. Eleanor and Lorena both scrambled for their cell phones as well. Nadine had her stockbroker on speed dial and was already screaming into her phone. Dump all of it, Sina Land. Yes, dump it all. I just heard from the horse's mouth that it's gone case. Lorena was on the other end of the bed, cupping her phone close to her mouth.
Desmond, I don't care. Just please start shorting it now.
Daisy began to hyperventilate. Sam Tonga, my heart hurts. I'm losing millions by the second. Where is my bloody broker? Don't tell me that moron is still at lunch. Carol Tai calmly reached for the touchscreen panel by her bedside table. Mei Mei, can you please come in and clean up a spill? Then she closed her eyes, lifted her arms into the air, and began to pray out loud. Oh, Jesus, our personal Lord and Savior, blessed be your name. We come to you humbly asking for your forgiveness today as we have all sinned against you. Thank you for sharing us with your blessings. Thank you, Lord Jesus, for the fellowship we shared today, for the nourishing food we enjoyed, for the power of your holy word. And please watch over dear sister Eleanor, sister Lorena, and sister Daisy as they try to sell their Sina Land shares. Carol opened her eyes for a moment, noting with satisfaction that Eleanor, at least, was praying along with her. But of course, she couldn't know that behind those serene eyelids, Eleanor was praying for something else entirely. A Taiwanese girl. Please, God, let it not be true. So I thought we'd kick things off with a little slideshow. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? This is off. Hello? Hello, hello, hello.
Here comes Sarah to rescue you.
Test. Test.
Okay. Hello? Hello again. Now this isn't working. Hello. Did I sit on something? Oh, okay. Here we go. So one of the sort of main themes of my book is really about the clash between old money and new money in Asia. And beyond that, the different generations and types of money that exist in Asia and have for centuries. And there's, you know, the term overseas Chinese refers to the Chinese that moved from mainland China to other parts of Asia, Southeast Asia, and around the Pacific Rim, some, you know, 200-300 years ago. And so I thought it'd be interesting to show some pictures from my own family album, beginning with my grandparents. It's my paternal grandfather and grandmother on their wedding day in Singapore. And this would have been 1931. So she, my grandmother was a very fashionable debutante in her day, and just wearing that sort of queen mother s 1920s, early 1930s outfit. And my grandfather, who was a young medical graduate from Hong Kong University, came to Singapore to marry her. It was an arranged marriage, and this was the second time they were meeting on their wedding day at her father's house. And that's my grandfather in his youth. He grew up in Shanghai, over on the left, and then he went to do his specialization in ophthalmology in Edinburgh, Scotland, in the 30s. And that's a picture from the Scottish days. But as you can see, there's this whole Anglophile, you know, sort of influence that comes in that I think not many people know about. And that's my grandmother in her youth over there in that leaf photograph. That's a very typical Peranakan outfit. The Peranakans are the Straits Chinese that intermarried with the native Malays that created this sort of beautiful fusion culture of Chinese and Malay traditions and handicrafts. And I think you can see that in that outfit of her as a youth. And then she's slightly older in some of the other pictures, and then there she is on the far right with my father in the early 30s. And here she is again with her friends in Singapore. Singapore, even in the 20s and 30s, was already a sort of a wealthy port city, being a very strategic trading port. And her father was a merchant and a banker, and he gave her a nice car, and she just ran around town with her friends. And this was one of the family houses in Singapore. It was originally a sultan's house. Was the Sultan of Johor had built it, and the name of the house is curiously enough called Buitenzorg, German name after a German town. But the house is, of course, now not around anymore, and it's now consists of what is known as the Orchard Road Commercial District in Singapore. But you can see sort of, you know, just sort of the style in which they lived, and it's not all rosewood and Chinese antiques. You know, for the time, they considered themselves very modern, and Art Deco was all the rage, and there you have it. So that's my great aunt in her bedroom at Buitenzorg. And then I just thought this was a very interesting postcard because it sort of illustrates how, you know, it was a postcard to my uncle, my granduncle. This would be my grandfather's brother. But, you know, this is a Chinese family living in China, Hong Kong, and Singapore, and they're all communicating in English. And this is a rather amusing one. I'll read it to you. It goes, Dear A Tian, cousins Anai and Ahui of Auntie Seven are coming over to our place to spend a day this coming Sunday. We're going to have some fun with firecrackers and desire that you and your sister to be presented also. You are under command, therefore, to come without fail at 10 a.m. that morning. You can go back to school from here, direct. And then it says on the side, P.S., don't be bashful. It is I, your kuze, which means your aunt. So I think he was being set up with someone. It sounds like it, you know, because he had to be coerced into coming to this party with firecrackers. And we jump quickly to Asia Now. And what's become of it. And this is a picture in Hong Kong at the Louis Vuitton store. And there's not a super sale happening. This is every day at Louis Vuitton in Hong Kong and has been the case for at least 10 years, I would say. I think in the 90s when I started visiting, I would notice all these lines outside Prada, Gucci, Hermes, and Louis Vuitton, only those four. And Chanel, actually. But it's gotten crazier and crazier as the mainland Chinese have continued to prosper over the decade.
Don't they go to Paris too? And
they
line
do.
Up
yeah.
In front of all
they do. But when they can't get to Paris, they go to Hong Kong. This is a famous Hong Kong socialite. Her name is Helen Ma. She prefers to go everywhere by helicopter to avoid the traffic in Hong Kong. And this is a chateau being built in suburban Beijing by a, you know, wealthy individual. He's named it Grand Chateau Lafitte. And I think his intention is also to be at the cornerstone of an entire town and a university that's modeled after Oxford and a golf course and you name it. But, you know, they're recreating and importing European culture to suburban Beijing. And lastly, this is a karaoke club in Beijing called, inexplicably, it's called L.A. Disco. And it's the priciest, most understatedly elegant karaoke club in Beijing. There are 500 employees, 100 female hostesses, and 102 private rooms. And it's very popular with businessmen to go close deals, you know, celebrate deals being done, things like that. But there we have it.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow. Kevin, what an amazing upbringing you had. And I see some of the things from your book, the Art Deco that was in the grandmother's house, we see right there. But you grew up with so much privilege. Did you feel when you were a little boy that it was a privileged existence?
Not at all. You know, I think as a child, you don't really have a means for comparison.
Did you have an ama?
I did have an ama. You know, I grew up with a nanny, but... You know, my family wasn't in any way ostentatious or showy, and instead there was a lot of emphasis on thrift and doing charitable work, and people constantly complaining that they didn't have enough money, you know. So as a child, I actually had this phobia that I would be homeless. I remember that was one of my big worries, because I went to Hong Kong one year when I was maybe 6 or 7 and saw a homeless person for the very first time, and I just couldn't wrap my head around the concept of someone with no place to live. So when I went back to Singapore, you know, my whole fear was, oh my God, we're going to be onto the streets. And
well,
you know,
you'd so say when when Nick was little, all of his New Year's money was taken away from him, and you said yours was too. So maybe this contributed to your feeling. But how much would a normal family have to give out in $100 gifts to kids when they went visiting on New Year's? I mean, it must have been.
I think it really depends. Back in those days, it was standard to give about $20 to $50, you know, each time you would visit a relative or a friend.
Every time.
Every time.
To all of them.
Yes.
And so it could be quite expensive.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would make out with a few $1,000.
And then they would take
every
it.
Every year, and then my parents would take it all. you know, because that was the way it was. But now it's become even more competitive from what I hear. You know, now I hear that $100 is the starting point these days in Singapore to give children
for
Chinese New Year.
So you grew up in a highly rarefied all Chinese family. You told me your grandmother had her shoes made in Paris. And we see all the beautiful parts, mm-hmm. but you also describe the rigidity of these old families. Did you experience that growing up?
Absolutely. Where should we start? I mean, you know, it was a very traditional Singaporean family. So, you know, one was expected to be a good citizen, become a good doctor, and, you know, spend a lot of time at church.
So when did your family leave China? Was it when your grandfather left to go to medical school, or did they come over way before?
My grandmother's family came over before. My grandfather was born in China, grew up in China and Hong Kong, and then he came to Singapore to marry my grandmother.
And
he had family in Singapore already.
I see. So how many years had your grandmother's family been away from China?
I think they moved at the turn of the century.
And how did they make their money before they moved? Did they have it in China, or did they make money?
My great-grandfather was a banker in China and a magistrate, and I think he moved to Singapore and set up new businesses there.
I see.
So, beyond that, I'm not really sure how.
Well, you're very different from these very rigid families. What do you think made you so different from your parents and grandparents?
New York City.
Yay!
Well, I think, you know, in a way, by the time my parents' generation came along, they were much less rigid. My father grew up partially in Australia.
Oh.
So he spent 10 years in college and boarding school in Australia. And so his mindset was much more westernized. And I think he had a lot of problems. He didn't want to go back to Singapore. And his parents, you know, forced him to after he graduated from college. To go back and do the dutiful thing, which is to get married and have lots of grandkids and,
yes.
you know, take care of your parents.
Were your grandparents happily married, having had an arranged marriage?
You know, they were. They really were. As my grandmother always says, you know, you just grow to love the person that you end up with, you know. And
So your descriptions of Asia's Gilded Age enters Edith Wharton territory with the old families looking down on the new billionaires. And I read that there are 122 billionaires in China that are listed in Forbes, but evidently there are many others because a lot of them want to be very secretive about their wealth.
Extremely so. Yeah, I think it's a running joke. I think whenever Forbes publishes its annual list of billionaires or whatever, you know, a lot of these Chinese families just laugh and laugh and laugh over the list because they're like, what's that family doing on the list? They don't have that much money, you know. Well, why is this family not on the list? I think something similar happens probably here, too, with the Forbes 400. You know, they have a lot of fun with it.
Are the old families as rich as the new billionaires, or are the new billionaires...
I think for the most part, no. I think the older fortunes are now dwarfed by these huge mega fortunes that are coming out of China because, you know, what's happened in China, it's really transformed really in the past decade. And the money that's been made from all the privatization of businesses and things like that, you know, the scale is just so much larger than anything possible in the rest of Asia.
When you were growing up, were there any of these new billionaires?
There were either Singaporean-made billionaires that were starting to build these huge fortunes, or you'd start to see a lot of these new families come in from Indonesia, from mainland China. So that was already beginning in a very quiet way. But, you know, the volume just has been amped up so much more, I think, in the past decade or so.
Well, it's such an education to me to read about your story of Rachel being rejected by Nick's family. And does this type of thing still go on, or is it?
Very much so. Very much so. I think you see that so much in so many different families. There's always in-laws that don't fit in and things like that, and petty jealousies against, you know, between different son-in-laws and sister-in-laws, and it all has to do with, you know, how they are perceived and what pecking order they're in.
So even though things have loosened up a little, it's still pretty rigid.
I think so, yeah. That's my perception of it.
When the book opens, it describes Eleanor and her sister being turned away from a grand hotel in London. Did this ever happen to anyone?
This was absolutely inspired by a true event that
I
know about, yeah.
And did they buy the hotel?
They did not buy the hotel. They threatened to buy the hotel. And they threatened actually to put a notice in every English language newspaper around the world the next day if they were not given their rooms.
Wow.
And so, you know, the hotel finally backed down. But subsequently, you know, I think four of the top hotels in London are now owned by Singaporean or Malaysian families. And so
wow.
I think there's something to that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, the girls you described are so vicious to Rachel at Araminta's bachelorette party. Is this kind of behavior something you encounter?
Even in New York, yeah.
I've never heard of anything.
I mean, you know, the book really is satirical, and it's meant to be very comical. So I have amped up a lot of the dramatic tension, you know, really for the fun of it.
Yes.
But, well, yeah, I think as with any culture, you know, there's a fair amount of bitchery going on.
Yes, yes.
But behind the scenes.
Well, the wealth you describe is so far beyond anything most of us have ever seen. And whoever dreamed of a climate-controlled closet like Eddie's, yet you claim you had to tone things down, that you had been to parties like the one you described.
Parties and weddings and houses that I've seen that have just been just so over the top. You can't, you know, my editor said, they'll never believe you if you put this in. You know, so I've left it out. You know, we need to have some realism here, and we need to keep the reader engaged.
Well, we love to read about the parties and the clothes and the food and all the things. So were you raised not to talk about money? That it was kind of
absolutely, yeah. I think my relatives are now just kind of reeling.
But you said that your mother likes the book,
yeah,
and your brother, so. That's good. And you described the Bible study group and the snobism of being an early convert to Christianity rather than, you know, a later. Tell us about your family's religion.
We are an early Christian family. In fact, we're the earliest, from what I'm told.
Well,
if family lore is
to
be believed.
And they read the King James Version.
Exactly. And
I think it's a much nicer version.
Okay.
So
thou thingest that too.
What were your favorite books growing up?
I really read a wide mixture of, fiction. I read a lot of nonfiction, actually. And, you know, Joan Didion is one of my favorite authors.
Oh.
So I've read everything she's ever written, and she's a profound influence on me. And
yeah.
The way she actually, you know, in her own way, looks at class is quite interesting, I find, you know, in her fiction and in her nonfiction. But beyond that, I also loved a lot of the great British writers, Jane Austen, you know, Anthony Trollope.
Because like your characters, you're quite an Anglophile.
You can't be helped. You know, when you grow up in Singapore, former colonial country, that's, you know, I grew up reading, you know, Blyton books. And
yeah, oh, I love those books. All,
you know, it's just very British in that
so
way.
So in addition to Joan Didion, who else of our current authors do you like to read?
I mean, I loved Dominic Dunn.
Yeah.
I mean, People Like Us, I think, was a big influence on Crazy Rich Asians. But, you know.
He told a great story.
A great story.
Yeah.
Alan Hollinghurst is definitely one of my favorites as well. And you're putting me on the spot. I can't think of a single author now. Yeah.
We'll come back.
Yeah.
Well, I know you like Jane Austen.
Jane Austen.
And Edith Wharton.
Edith Wharton and
a lot of others.
Exactly.
You wrote a book on luck, and your book has had tremendous success. Did you apply any of your luck rules in promoting your book?
Well, I have a few rituals that I like to, you know, sort of keep in place. Like I'll listen to my lucky song before I go on a book tour or give a presentation,
yes.
You know, things like that. But, you know.
Well, it certainly worked. Whatever you did, whatever. Keep doing those rituals.
Hopefully, yeah.
So your book has been acquired for the movies. Tell us about that.
I think it's going to be very exciting. I think it's Nina Jacobson, who has really had a good track record of bringing books to life into movies. She adapted The Hunger Games from the Young and Out Novels series.
Oh.
And before that, she did a children's series called Diary of a Wimpy Kid. And she really was looking for the right adult book property to really sort of, and she just fell in love with the story and made a very compelling case as to why she needed it to make this a movie. So I've sort of taken a leap of faith, and we'll see what happens.
Will you have any control over what happens once they start? Or?
Probably not.
You have a leap of faith.
Yeah, no, I think she's always worked very closely with her authors.
Oh, good.
And they've always been very happy with the results.
Excellent.
And for her also, she said it's very important that the readers and the fans love the movie as much as they love the book.
Yes.
She doesn't want to alienate that as an audience. So, it'll be very interesting to see what happens. I think there's been tremendous interest in it, especially from the Asian and the Asian American communities, to see this representation of,
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
People on screen that aren't just Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt.
So what has it been like for you to have such a huge success with your first novel?
It's been really great. I mean, I'm extremely grateful and still, I think, in a bit of a shock that things have taken such interesting twists and turns.
Yes. Very exciting. So tell us your plans for continuing with the story.
I had always conceived the book as a trilogy, and that's what I'm planning to do. I'm now writing book two.
Good.
And hopefully that will lead me immediately into book three.
Do you have any idea how long we have to wait for?
Hopefully not too long. I mean, we're planning on publishing, I think, in 2015.
Oh, great.
So
good.
You have to give me a little time to write it, and then they have to correct all my grammatical errors and then publish it. But so every other year to finish out the series, basically, is the plan.
Excellent. And do you have any ritual when you do your writing? Do you go to a special place and do it, or...?
I have a space that I go to write specifically, I do meditate. So I usually do a meditation every day before I start writing.
And you said it flowed pretty easily.
It really, for book one, it did. Let's see what happens at book two. But
For
book one, it was a story that just kind of I just started writing one day and just said, let's see, what will happen if I take this idea. And actually, the chapter I read, the Bible study chapter, was the first chapter I had written of the book. And then the story began to just tell itself from there in a very, very strange way, just sort of evolved.
So is there any question that no one has asked that you'd like to answer?
I can't think of any.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll open it up now. And does anyone have any questions?
There's also a couple.
I don't know. We can't. Okay, they'll just ask. I guess we can't pass it around.
My question is, you talk about charity balls in the part you read. In this country, a very healthy percentage of the billionaires have pledged over half of their wealth to go to charity. Is there a similar phenomenon among the Chinese billionaires, the overseas Chinese billionaires, or are they keeping it all in the family?
I think you're seeing more of a consciousness towards philanthropy emerge now. And there have been a couple of families, I think, that have joined that pledge that Warren Buffett and Bill and Melinda Gates made, to sort of, I think they're going to give the majority of their fortunes away to charity. So you're seeing some of these new families, I think, join that. But for the most part, I think, traditional old money Chinese families, they want to keep it in the family. And it's about perpetuating the dynasty and leaving as much money as possible to future generations. It's still very much part of the culture.
Do we have one more question?
Yeah.
Chinese diaspora. Mm-hmm. A bit more accurate. And secondly, when you wrote the book, did you have the entertainment food chain in mind? Book, film, TV show, you know, sequels, or did you just write it for fun and profit?
To answer your first question, I had a much more literary poetic title in mind when I first started writing the book. But whenever people asked me, friends would ask me, what are you writing about? I would just say, oh, I'm just writing a book that's about Crazy Rich Asians. And that sort of evolved, and it, you know, I would get the reaction out of that. And I really, you know, I love the double entendre of the title. You know, are they crazy, comma, rich Asians, or are they crazy rich Asians? And it's been very gratifying to see that now there are so many Asians who are calling themselves Crazy Rich Asians since the book has come out. So it's there was a lot of concern, I think, at first, you know, especially within my family. I had so many urgent phone calls from relatives saying, please, 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 you're going to be pillared if you, you know, release a book with that title. And it has so far proven to be not the case. So it was a happy accident, I think. And number two, I really wrote the book just for pure fun. It was really an experiment, and it just felt that there were all these stories in me that I wanted to just sort of put down on paper and see what happened. So there was no grand scenario of creating a multimedia empire out of it. But it's great to see that there's been interest in from the film world and from the TV world and from all these other people, and, you know, let's see what happens. I think there's some questions.
Oh, yeah, there's
a lady there. Yeah. Extremely so. Extremely so. I think especially amongst the overseas Chinese families, there's a lot of concern. There's always been concern, I think, about what China has done over the past 50, 60 years. Because in a lot of the cases, these people still have relatives in mainland China. So the overseas Chinese have really watched with great interest what's happened to China, mainland China, that is. And continue to do so.
But as far as the greediness of China in taking over countries, is the criticism within?
The criticism within China?
Yes.
I think there might be, but I think, you know, very few people really speak out publicly about it, because, you know, the rich Chinese in China, they want to, you know, maintain their fortunes, and so they're very guarded in terms of criticizing, you know, the regime and what, you know, what happens within the government. And, you know, there's a very it's still very much a loaded gun.
Okay, one more over there.
Very much so. I think there is very much a local Singaporean identity that they're very proud to be this distinctive hybrid culture with their own customs, with their own traditions, with their own slang called Singlish, you know, and the cuisine and everything. And I think a lot of them like to think that, you know, it's a country that has, it's very new, but they've done it right. You know, the population has prospered, you know, from a swampy backwater island to the richest island in the world per capita. So I think there is a lot of national pride there.
Anyone else? I have one more. Oh, okay, then we'll ask that then.
Wealthy Well, that's an interesting question, because I think what you're seeing now is that a lot of both the mainland Chinese and overseas Chinese are sending their children abroad to American, Australian, Canadian, and European universities. So especially for the mainland Chinese, you know, they're buying a lot of New York real estate, for example. They're parking their money in New York and London and Singapore. They're getting it out of mainland China because, you know, they've made it. They don't know how long the party is going to last. And so it's a way to sort of manage their wealth. And you'll see these families where, you know, the husband remains in Beijing working, but the wife lives in California with the children. And the children go to school in California, things like that. So money for a lot of the mainland Chinese has been a means to get out of China. And they're moving, you know, not just to the States, but also to Singapore and to Hong Kong, and that thereby creating a lot of new social problems there.
So we have another question from Harriet.
Yes, just one other question. What is the anecdote that your editor thought
no one would believe? It wasn't really an anecdote. There were so many specific examples of just different things, you know, like how people, the use of helicopters to get everywhere, for example, and... You know, she was like, there's one too many private jet scene. We just have to get that out because it's just, you know, it's getting sickening at this point. You know, the amount of carbon dioxide is polluting the world with these people flying everywhere. So things like that, you know, some of the descriptions of the houses or the spending sprees were a little too over the top for her, and she thought would really alienate the reader from appreciating that character. So, and I think she was right. In many, many ways.
Kevin, I have another question to ask you. You left this very opulent life in Singapore, and then you came to the United States. And how did your life change when you got here?
I wouldn't say I ever really lived an opulent life in Singapore. I think, you know, I lived a privileged life in that, you know, I grew up with a good education and, you know, good food on the table every day. But, you know, my family wasn't one of these excessively... sort of, you
just
know.
The right amount.
Yeah. Well, but it did change drastically when I moved to the States. I mean, I grew up with nannies and servants, and I didn't know the meaning of housework. And, you know, I had to adjust very immediately to living in suburban USA without my nanny, without any maids. And I think that was part of my father's master plan. You know, he grew up very self-sufficient in Australia. And he wanted his children to grow up independent and just, you know, down to earth.
Was it hard for you?
The first year was very, very hard. You know, I remember just being in complete culture shock in a way. Because even though I was speaking English, you know, I was so much more Anglophile.
Yes.
Than the average Texan, you know. So it was a strange way to sort of get to know America. And I had to make adjustments very quickly. I had to lose that accent very quickly.
Yes, I can imagine.
But, you know, I think things happen for a reason, and I'm very grateful for what's happened, because I don't think I would be a writer had I stayed in Singapore. I don't think I would have been able to have a creative life in Singapore. I think I'd probably be in banking or something.
Well, we're glad that you came here and did write this wonderful book. And does anyone have any more questions? Oh, we have another one.
I was curious to know, has this book been translated into Chinese, and also has it been distributed to other Asian countries, and how is it doing? Obviously, how was it received in Singapore, as well as, you know, other countries, basically, and what the reactions have been? So I'm just curious.
There is an international English export edition that is being sold throughout Asia. So in Singapore, in Hong Kong, in the Philippines, for example, Indonesia, you know, all in English language bookstores, it's being sold there, and it's doing very, very well. And the Singaporeans have really loved the book. So far I'm not getting, you know, pillared and stoned. It has not been bought for Chinese language rights yet that I know of. And I think, you know, the Chinese are a bit skeptical about this book. But that seems to be a problem of a lot of literature coming out of the U.S. that's about Asia. That, you know, there's some really great books that have never been translated into Chinese, like Janice Lee's The Piano Teacher, for example. Beautiful novel set in Hong Kong. She can't for the life of her get someone to buy the Chinese translation rights. They're just not interested. You know, they'd rather be watching Gossip Girl, I think. So, you know. Well, I had a, you know, my parents were much more liberal in that sense. They didn't have really too many expectations compared to some other Asian parents. So there was much less pressure on me to become a doctor or a lawyer, even though I think they would have liked it. You know, they accepted that, you know, I was a creative individual and I should go off and do what I wanted. So they were very supportive when I moved to New York to go to art school, for example. Which is rare, so I'm very lucky in that respect.
You mentioned there's a movie in the works?
There is a movie in the works, yes.
You talked about that?
Yeah, it's being developed by a producer named Nina Jacobson, and we are now at the stage where we're trying to select the best scriptwriter to adapt the book into a screenplay.
Good.
And so it's been passed along to some really talented people, and we'll see. We're going to find the right person and take it from there.
Well, I'd like to thank you all for coming, and let's thank Kevin.